Welcome to Phantom Podcast Network. This is Legal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of 1980s action cinema. Celebrating the heroes of yesterday, Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Bruce Willis, Van Damme, all the way down to, of course, the B-grade action films that we all enjoyed on VHS, and of course, Betamax, with the loves of American Ninja, all the way through to Cyborg Cop and beyond. Here at Phantom Podcast Network's Legal Mullet Podcast, join Adam O'Brien as we celebrate action movie cinema. G'day folks, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien, Legal Mullet, here on Phantom Podcast Network. Comes to you live in Quinlan's Cantina and the very warm Gold Coast of Australia. It's one of the humid times of the year. That's right, November, as we head into, of course, summer in December. This is the warmest, driest, and most irritating weather you're ever going to find. And it's the kind of weather you're going to find on the planet Arrakis, which we're going to talk about tonight here on the show. So, folks, I hope you've had a great week. It's been a very busy one here, and definitely one filled with a lot of Star Wars. There's a lot of you out there checking out, of course, The Mandalorian, and, of course, all the Disney Plus, and, of course, the McClunky. That's right, folks. If you haven't got Disney Plus, that would be all of our listeners in the United States would have it right now. Australia's got it in a couple of days' time. And, of course, one of those things is GL has been busy yet again making different edits of A New Hope. Now, these are ones that were made while he was still in tenure of the running the actual company of Lucasfilm itself before he sold it. And he was getting the films ready for a 3D release or a 4K release, one of the two. And, of course, now Greedo says McClunky before he dies. That's right, he says McClunky. McClunky. What the hell is McClunky? So, of course, that's the new meme that's all over the place. McClunky. So, of course, that is one and the same. Is the different edits that they've done on this over the years. Obviously, you know, Greedo shooting first, Han shooting first in the original, and now McClunky. So you can find chat about that and more on, of course, Fantha Tracks, the Fantha from Down Under, which is my other show over on the Fantha Tracks radio show. So tonight we're going to be going through the 1984 David Lynch film. We have covered it here about a year ago. Not on this show, but on another one entirely. But this being a 1980 specials, this show is dedicated to the 1980s. We are going to go through the Lynch film. This is more of, for people that haven't actually seen the film before or don't know Dune, they only know of it by its name or know of it as David Lynch's film that he never talks about. We're going to talk about what worked in it, what didn't. I'm going to keep it as broad as I can, so that people get a feel of what Dune's all about. And of course, a lot of what you're going to find in this film was the fact that David Lynch had to do exactly the same thing. He had to make it approachable for people that may not have read the books and just want to go to the cinemas and see a great science fiction film. Did it meet its audience expectations? Nope. Not by a long shot. But of course, it's a cult film. You know, it's one that a lot of people would enjoy and some don't. But we're going to look at the influence Star Wars had in it, and of course, you know, the lines of making this a film that really doesn't match up to those. Does it not? We're going to talk about that all here on Lethal Mullet Podcast.
May the McClunky be with you now.
All right, folks, if you want to catch up with the Lethal Mullet, you can subscribe to the show on both iTunes, that's right, the Apple Podcasts. You can catch us also on Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, and anywhere where you can find good podcasts. You can catch the entire Phantom Podcast Network catalogue of podcasts and more, and even our back catalogue, that's right, all on the master feed of fpnet.podbean.com. Make sure you check out all the other shows like Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast, and of course, all the other fantastic shows like Culture Clash, weekly look at pop culture, founded by Kyle Wagner and Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel, all on the Phantom Podcast Network. You can catch me, the Lethal Mullet, on social media at The Lethal Mullet on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Make sure you join up with the Facebook page. Lots of fun chat and look at all the old great films there as well. We'll see you out there on the web.
And now for your feature presentation.
Alrighty, folks, here we go. We're going to be talking about 1984 Dune, directed by David Lynch, based on this 1965 Frank Herbert science fiction novel, which is largely considered an absolute masterpiece. And it's a film itself that I quite enjoy. I didn't when I was younger, and I'll go into why I don't think it really piqued my interest back then as well. It also was the start of Kyle MacLachlan's relationship with David Lynch, as far as a professional relationship, working together on this, Twin Peaks, and a lot of other work they've done together. It's one of those, he's kind of like, you know, I suppose a little bit like Harrison Ford with George Lucas. They're two kindred spirits when it comes to artistry and working together. And if you're a fan of Twin Peaks like I am as well, then you'll know that obviously he is such a great character in that series. And of course, Lynch's creation as well. So the film itself is literally the entire first novel in, you know, basically distillated down to its bare essentials. But even then, it doesn't have the story of Dune in it itself. It's a very chaotic script. It's all over the place. And there's been things taken out of it and put into it, and we'll talk about a little bit about that, but the main thrust of the story is about a house called House Atreides from the planet of Caladan, who are gifted the planet Arrakis with the spice. So it's the only place in the entire Imperium, entire universe, that creates the spice melange, which is kind of like, in today's terms, it'd be like oil, you know, or anything of that sort of high value that is basically could put it to a monopoly. And then that they're basically given, it's a gift in some ways, but it's also a trap. Their enemies, the House Harkonnen, working alongside the Emperor with House Carino, basically conspiring to take out the house, because they're, in this version of Dune, they are basically building a weapon that threatens the likes of the Imperium and, of course, the Emperor, Shaddam the Fourth. So the film itself gives you a little bit of that, but I think what happens is because they're trying to extrapolate so much from the novel, it slows down. But in its barest form, it is a coming-of-age story of a duke and of an emperor. And that is, of course, the character of Paul Atreides. It's a different character from the heroes that you're used to in science fiction, but it's also a classic hero as well. But as we go through, you can kind of see, especially if you go into the further books, Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, in that first trilogy of Dune, you can see what Frank does with heroes, charismatic figures, leaders, and when they make mistakes. It really shows down, like, us that blindly follow those leaders and where they go. So it's a very clever story. There's so many different layers. There's some great characters and villains. This film itself is one of the most beautifully designed films out there. I personally, the look of the film itself is fantastic. If any, the only thing is, you know, it's how the film was edited and just doesn't quite match up to what you would put in terms of Dune, in your head at least, or in your head canon of how a movie like that would be made. But it's an almost impossible story to put to film. I'm hoping that Denis Villeneuve can do that, because it's just such a rich tapestry. The novel itself has multiple layers, different things going on, and the way that it's written by Frank Herbert is an absolute godsend. It really is a story that you start a journey on, and you're coming in and out of that journey here and there with different characters and their plight and how they relate to each other. So well written when it comes to the characters. The dialogue is amazing. And again, you read this novel and it really takes you away to another place. But the characters are so relatable because they are like the characters in life around you. You know, they're going through the same struggles, although heightened, obviously, because it's science fiction. The film itself, of course, was one that's been developed and in development hell for years. Of course, Jodorowsky was going to do a version of Dune at one stage. There's also Ridley Scott going to do a version of Dune at one stage as well. I've always wanted to see what Ridley Scott was going to do. I think Alejandro Jodorowsky had such a vision for Dune. It would have been completely different from, probably even more so than Lynch's version, but it would have been such an amazing vision just for a science fiction story and novel by itself. And, of course, there's a great documentary out there you can all check out, which has, of course, his view on how it would have been made, how it all came together, and just some of the cast in that version of Dune would have been absolutely amazing.
You're listening to the Lethal Mullet Podcast on Phantom Podcast Network.
All right, we're going to talk about the cast now of this amazing film. Obviously, we've talked about some of the people involved already, the director, and, of course, Paul Atreides, played by Kyle MacLachlan. I will say this about Kyle: does a perfect job of playing, you know, the shallow youth who's only knowing the bare minimum of things, that hasn't really learnt about his surroundings yet. A little bit like Mark Hamill did with Luke Skywalker, but he really grows, and you can see that there's a real authority to him, especially when they join the Fremen and they're starting to show off their weaponry, the weirding modules and stuff like that. His mother is played by Francesca Annis. That is, of course, Lady Jessica. Now, Lady Jessica is part of what they call the Bene Gesserit, who are a sisterhood that have been basically breeding for X amount of generations, for thousands of years, basically, to create the ultimate super being. And, of course, that's through genetic breeding, of looking through the lines of people in power, and basically come down to eventually, through the ways of pairing the right partners together and stuff like that, to make the chosen one. And the chosen one is one that will have the power to sort of look inside the histories through the mind, the inner eye, as they say in Dune. It's for somebody new to Dune, it's very hard to sort of see what they're doing. But basically what they've done is the Bene Gesserit themselves use the spice as a way to see the truth in things. So basically, truth says, which you'll see. And she is, of course, one of the key ingredients in this film. If anything, I think she pretty much steals a lot of the scenes that she's in. She's a fantastic talent, and obviously she's in a lot of great movies in the 1980s. In particular, one of my favourites, Krull. You've also got Brad Dourif playing Peter DeVries. Again, Brad Dourif always playing the great, crazy characters in this case. Peter's the assassin and side character to the main bad guy. And that is, of course, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, head of House Harkonnen. And, of course, they are the arch rivals and enemy to House Atreides. There's a blood vendetta that's gone back thousands of years to the Battle of Corran, where one of them betrayed the other. And, of course, that's gone on for generations, the hate between the two. You've also got Jose Ferrer. Of course, that's Miguel Ferrer's father. Miguel Ferrer, you might remember from, of course, Robocop. Very good in that one. Of course, in Jose Ferrer, I'd known for quite a few films, and I think the big one was Jackie Chan's The Battle Creek Brawl, where he played a mob boss in it. You've also got Linda Hunt playing Shutout Mabes, who's basically one of the Arakeen population who turns out to be a Fremen. Again, the Fremen in this are going to be ones that you'll see are basically, in some ways, the greatest warriors, those that live off the sands of Dune itself and fight like the greatest guerrilla army you've ever seen. They're fantastic. Richard Jordan in this plays Duncan Idaho. Duncan Idaho's right-hand man to House Atreides. He's their swordmaster, one of the greatest warriors they've got. But also, Richard Jordan brings, for this small amount of time, a real charisma to this character. Virginia Madsen plays Princess Irulan, who's basically the head of the family, right up to the Emperor itself. And you very, very much, very minimal in this sort of story. You see her at the start, you see her at the end of the film, and of course she opens the movie, I suppose a little bit like in Star Wars, we get the rundown, the titles, and of course the layout of where we are. And this, you get it from Princess Irulan like you do in the book itself. You've also got Everett McGill from Twin Peaks, and there's Stilgar, who's the great Fremen leader and Naib of the tribe that teaches Paul Atreides the ways of the desert and the ways of the Fremen. You've also got Jack Nance, who, of course, all of these guys are regulars when it comes to David Lynch. Jürgen Prochnow. Jürgen Prochnow is one of my favorite actors out there. He's always been fantastic since the first few movies I've seen him in. Dune's probably one of the first, but I've also seen Das Boot, and Das Boot he was fantastic in. And it's one of those films where you see, these young men going away on a U-boat, going off to a mission, and they come back, scraggly, old beards, weather-beaten, completely malnourished, and just ready to basically drop. And it's just so well done. In this, he plays Duke Leto Atreides with real gusto. You know, look, he's really into it. And, of course, he has on his side Patrick Stewart playing Gurney Halleck, the master at arms, basically, that always helps out on the side of the Duke. And, of course, he's Paul's pretty much right-hand man as well. He's almost like an eccentric uncle to Paul. And they get up to all sorts of mischief. You've also got Dean Stockwell, of course, from Quantum Leap and many other things, as Dr. Wellington Yue. He's the doctor, or what they call the Sook doctor, who's the most trusted when it comes to all things, medically with the family and stuff like that. But as we see in the film, there's quite a bit of betrayal in there too. Max von Sydow is Dr. Kynes, the planetologist who's sent by the Emperor to basically check on Arrakis itself and make sure that the change of directorship of that place is all under rights. You've also got Sheldon Young as Cheney, and of course, David Lynch is actually in the movie as a spice worker. And you actually see him in a sequence where he's talking directly to the Duke and trying to save the lives, along with the Duke, of his men and the spice. So it's a massive all-star cast, a little bit like Denis Villeneuve's new one, and I think you're going to be very excited to see exactly how this new one fares in that way too, because you've got this cast, but you still have to go through and actually make a solid picture. And that's the hard thing. To actually get that all together and pushed in the right way is, a mission in itself. So you've got to hand it to any director that has the courage to take on a project like this. As we mentioned, they'd been in development hell pretty much for 10 years or longer. But in 1974, the option was acquired from when Arthur P. Jacobs actually had the film rights back in, I think it was 1971. Can't imagine it actually being made for the sort of budgets they had and the sort of technology they would have had back then. But there's no denying Planet of the Apes is a fantastic series. So particularly the first film that still resonates even now today. Yeah, even on 4K, Blu-ray, it's such one of those amazing visions. But 3 or 4 years later, when Alejandro Jodorowsky was putting it together, he wanted to come up with, something that was even sort of, visual feast. It was acid jazz for the eyes, pretty much. He had bands like Pink Floyd and Magma, probably get Mick Jagger, because Mick Jagger was cast in this as well, to put stuff down for each of the planets as far as, musically and stuff. This would have been even more so than like Flash Gordon had with Queen. It would have been a musical as well as a huge opus. I mean, it was going to be a 10-hour film. So you're talking about something that was just, I mean, it's unfilmable as is because it's such a big story, but to make it even more so, particularly if you watch the Jodorowsky's Dune documentary, you actually see the book, this massive tome of, production stuff and also all the story boards and stuff like that he put together. So you actually get to see that vision that he had. And, of course, it's a massive vision. It's huge. He had Dan O'Bannon involved, who would go on to do, obviously, Alien and many other things for the visual effects side of it. And also Giga, Jean Giraud, obviously, Mobius. And, of course, Chris Foss has done some of the greatest science fiction book covers you'll ever see. But you had Udo Kier as Peter DeVries, David Carradine as Leto Atreides, Jodorowsky's son Brontus was going to play Paul, and Mick Jagger was going to play Fade Rauther. Orson Welles as Baron Harkonnen and Salvador Dali as the Emperor. I mean, look at that. That's a cast and a half, isn't it? But also, one of the great things too about his vision was that you got to explore a little bit more you know, visually of what is outside of even the scenes in the book that Frank put together. There's a pirate chase for spice and stuff like that. There's all these different things. So you can check those out. Just Google it online. You'll probably find some examples of what they were going to do. But unfortunately, it failed. And to get, I think it was backing for the actual filming itself. And you can see the whole story in 2013 documentary Jodorowsky's Dune. It's such an amazing you know, vision. It's a shame that we never got it. Of course, then when Dino De Laurentiis, back in about 76, then when got the rights to put together, and of course, he worked side and side with Frank Herbert to really get that out. And, you know, Frank himself talked about it in his little book of anthology, basically of short stories called I. And in that, you get to see at the start a little, it's basically a little couple, three-page thing about Dune itself. He talks about, you know, being on the production and, yeah, just what, you know, from an author side of things to see, you know, what it is. You know, his introduction's absolutely stellar. And you really get, you know, some a sense of what it was like for somebody that writes on a page and gives you that, you know, vision, cinematic vision in the theatre of your mind, how he's then going to talk to, obviously, Dino Laurentiis about how do I actually put that down into a visual sense. So it had a script that was probably 3 to 4 hours worth of footage filming. It's gone ahead, and De Laurentiis then went and got this young director who'd just done, I think they'd just done or about to do The Duelist. And, of course, that's Ridley Scott. And, you know, you've got H.R. Giger involved at that stage. I think, you know, at that early stage, it's great that he found Giger because, of course, Giger would then be such a big influence on the Xenomorphs and, you know, the mythology of that universe, even right up to, obviously, Prometheus and Alien Covenant. It really became a staple of what it was. And really, Scott was interested in really adapting this to make it, you know, something that is deeply mythological, but also a fairy tale, but a dark fairy tale, in comparison to, say, Star Wars, you know, which is where they were leaning towards, obviously, because the film had just done so well, you know, in 77. But they used the Battle of Algiers, which is, you know, a movie I probably only saw a couple of years ago, as a point of reference. And you can see kind of roughly what they were do visually in that sense, especially with the Fremen and the raids they would do, obviously, on the Harkonnen when the Harkonnen took Dune back. But a lot of that, of course, after his elder brother passed away, he was really just drawn back. He knew Dune was going to be too much work and decided not to pursue it. And then, of course, we got my second favorite film in the world, and that is, of course, Blade Runner. You know, Blade Runner is just one of those films that is a visual feast. And, of course, you can just imagine that kind of vision to really put it back down. I mean, it's there's nothing quite like it. It wasn't until the 1980s when, of course, Lynch got really interested in doing, you know, something else. He'd done The Elephant Man, very successful. And Raffaella, who's Dino's daughter, was then running a lot of the films, and she looked around for a director of interest, one that would really spark up an amazing production, and of course seen The Elephant Man, and wanted to see if David Lynch would actually do the film. And that time he was talking to George Lucas about Return of the Jedi, which was in around about probably 1980 or late 80 to 81 as I was starting the film. And you know, you can imagine him having to compete with, of course, George's already set vision of that universe. You know, you'd be walking into a job that pretty much you can't design, you can't do anything outside of what George would want at that stage, because it's a set vision already, pretty much. And, of course, David Lynch is somebody that needs a lot more breadth and a lot more, you know, clear area for his mind to go. And, of course, he went ahead and decided not to do Return of the Jedi, and then sat down and worked on the scripts and got moving and got this film made. And, God, he made a Lynch movie. Be sure to check out Dan Hadley's Spacebook on Facebook. It's amazing.
Alright, Mullet, tell me what the film looks like.
Lynch's film is very interesting in the design of the film itself. Dune is a very old universe. It's the year 10,191, and Earth is gone. It's long gone. Everyone's moved on to other planets. So the technology that they've got is something that's been there for a long time. And of course, it being so far ago, also they had machines, robots, all that sort of technology, but it overthrew humanity thousands of years before. So with that, a lot of technology is being cut off. So thinking machines are banned due to the uprisings. Kind of like the Terminator, if you like. You know, they had their own version of the Terminator in some way, where the machines put humans into slavery. So there's a reason for them not having the kind of technology you're used to in, say, Star Wars or vice versa. It's a very baroque, broken down. And if anything, the technology is going to the humans in different schools of thought. So in terms of humans, the computers have now been the forming of the human mind to compute in the way that a computer does. And they're called mentats, so human hybrid with obviously computer mind. But that's through training where basically the calculations that a computer makes can be done in the mind. It's possible thanks to the sort of training they do and obviously the way that school is put together. So the school of the mentats. School of the Bene Gesserit, which we talked about earlier, how they're obviously, it's a political party in some ways, where they're growing towards the universe's super being. You also have the Spacing Guild, which is a monopoly that uses the spice to help them basically use these pilots, these navigators of huge highliner ships that can go from one spot in the universe instantaneously to another, but the pilots see the correct way through and do it with basically pure mathematics. You can really get it through there. Of course, there's also the Swordmaster School and many others there too. But the reason is because obviously we've gone to that stage where we're thousands of years ahead of this, the kind of technologies that are there. So they still have atomic weapons. They still have a lot of that sort of stuff. There's ornithopters, which are these almost helicopter-like, but also bird-like you know, ships that can basically fly through the sky, but they flap wings to keep them in air, so just to keep that thing level. You can see them in the Dune miniseries, the way that works, more or less the lines of that sort of thing. But I think we're going to see something slightly different in the new film. But also you have in that, obviously the ships, you have all that weaponry. But for some reason, when you see this, if you're new to Dune, you see the weaponry itself. So it's daggers, swords, pistols at most. But they have body shields. So each soldier, guard, vice versa, has these little belts, which are called shield belts. You can click on that and a full body shield goes around you. So it can pretty much protect you against blasts and most lace guns rounds, or basically laser guns. But, however, they can be penetrated by a slow blade, which can actually get through it and still cut you. The other reason that they've stopped using a lot of other heavier weapons is because a laser gun shield can actually cause an atomic blast in itself too, due to the effect that it has. So there's the reasoning behind it becoming a more medieval in some ways. And of course, because now there's all these fiefdoms, all these different planets that are run by basically families, like it was in the medieval days, that's why you have these huge monopolies and huge, it's like just like the old castles and feudal era. It's a very feudal society, but it's also advanced society. So in this, it's given a Baroque kind of a look. It's Gothic in some ways. There's even an influence of Giga in some of the designs in, I think, especially the castle steps in Culloden and things like that. There's just, it's such a dark, bleak sort of vision. But even right through to the sort of beautiful deserts of Arrakis and the designs of Arrakeen, it's just beautifully put together.
So, why didn't it work?
In a nutshell, David Lynch's Dune didn't work because it was compressing so much of the story. Even the Lynch cut itself was literally largely cut very tight. But also taking, you know, distilling down some of the more pragmatic but also deep sort of issues that Frank was putting in there. Things like water on Arrakis. I mean, there's rain at the end of the film. You know, okay, that's a visual representation of what the Atreides were doing, and even Liet Kynes, the planetologist, was trying to gradually grow the the agriculture itself, or the actual dune itself, so that we become a different climate. Obviously have green pastures even. So there's that. There's also obviously the adding of the biggest thing, the biggest point of contention in the actual film itself, which is, of course, the weirding module. So here's this gun that's built off, it's basically a laser gun that's built off voice. And of course, the voice is a thing that the Bene Gesserit uses, Paul uses, his mother uses, where it's put to such a low point that it can be very suggestive to people when they say it. And really, basically, a little bit like the Jedi, you can suggest people to do things, and if they're weak-willed enough, it will happen. In this film, they use that, and there's kind of a little bit of telepathy involved in this film, although it's not in the books. It's not what they do. So what's interesting about that is that you've got these sound guns, which are basically a visual representation of the voice, getting to a next level, and it shows... In some ways, it's clever from Lynch's side to get across the point that, he's building his skill with the voice. And by the time you get to the end of the story, like in the novel, one of the Fremen fighters says he can kill with a word because he's actually able to use his voice without the voice module. But, of course, it is also the weapon that apparently scares the Emperor, this army with a secret weapon. So, again, it's smart in that way, but it's also taking away the great skills of the Bene Gesserit there, martial art, the Prana Bindu training, and basically it would have been Kung Fu on the sand dunes. So you can kind of see where they were coming from in that point. But of course, then there's also bringing this story down too short. I mean, it really needed to be a 3 hour, maybe 3.5 hour film to really tell the story. And this is the smart thing with Denis Villeneuve, is actually making two separate films. So you're actually splitting up the book pretty much evenly down the line, and you're getting two films to spread out that story. So there is a fair bit to love about the film. Sting is fantastic as the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen's nephew, who's basically trying to take over. But you also get some of the greatest lines at the end of the film, which today is thought of. I think I've even seen it on a T-shirt, I will kill him. These sort of real outlandish, even Shakespearean sort of outrageousness, the way that he plays the role. There's some great action. The model work in this film is fantastic. It really still holds up to this day. And, there's a sort of beauty in that way. But the film still is chaos. It's it's a tough one to watch. For me, it is the better version of Dune because it has that substance. It's harder for me to watch the miniseries, which was done by Sci-Fi, even though that is a better translation of Dune, but the effects work, because it's such primitive CGI at the time, is harder to hold up. It's still a great and fantastic vision, but that's the only thing that takes me out. The performances and the work done on that miniseries are far better when it comes to telling Frank's vision. Ian McNeice was fantastic as the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. Alec Newman as Paul Atreides does a fantastic job. William Hurt as Duke Leto. And, of course, they even went further and did, after that, Children of Dune, which I think is probably the best adaptation. It's an adaptation of Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, the two sequels which wrap out the trilogy of the first trilogy of Dune. And that one's probably the better film, better miniseries, better budget. The CGI is far better. And if anything, I think the recasting of some of those roles is really, really good. So in closing, folks, check out David Lynch's film. It's not perfect. It's certainly not one up the sort of standard that you're used to. But it's certainly something that will open your eyes to what Dune is. But definitely then, chuck on the Dune miniseries, and definitely Children of Dune. It's they're just absolutely spot on when it comes to getting the majority of the story right in Arrakis and Dune. All right, folks, that is everything for this week on Lethal Muller Podcast. I'm glad you joined us. We'll catch us next week as we do more 80s action films and more here on the Phantom Podcast Network. We'll see you next time. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night. See you later.
Make sure that you subscribe to Phantom Podcast Network on the Masterfeed at Phantom Podcast Networks, fpnet.podbean.com.